I think in your life, you must at some point make this fundamental choice for unity or division, for hatred or love. Either people are moving to more extremism, which is more division and anger, or people make a choice that their life is going to move towards unity and love. It's a fundamental choice.
Welcome to Wrestling with God Show, the podcast where we grapple with big questions about faith, religion, and life. I'm Irish McMahon, and I'm here with a guy who can be a little prickly at times. But his prickliness is almost always intended to promote unity and love. He's my friend, an Irish Catholic priest, Father Len McMillan. Hey, Father Len.
Hey, how are you doing, Irish? Although prickly, that kind of hurt my feelings. I'm very sensitive. Please stop
it. Well, you may have forgotten, Father Len, that's a self-description. You've often described yourself as a little prickly. So, I mean, that demonstrates a lot of self-awareness on your part. I like it.
A little hard to miss. So.
All right. So, Father Len, you know, there's lots of division and anger and not much unity in our country at the moment. And that division and anger has even filtered down to the Catholic Church and your parish there in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And I know you've been thinking a lot about what's causing this division and how corrosive and self-defeating it could be, and what can be done to bring us all together. So, Father Len, let's dive into this. Okay. What have you been thinking about?
Well, I have been thinking about this because so many little incidents that I'm going to tell you a couple vignettes. So, like up here, we have a Catholic school, and somebody put a video out that when celebrating Mass, there's this thing that you're not celebrating Mass right if you hold your hands open. That's called the Oren position, like Jesus on the cross. That's what the priest holds his hands that way, and gave rather a stern directive that you're not allowed to do that. The only problem is nowhere does that ever appear in the rubrics. So you've just created a rule that has everybody upset thinking they're celebrating Mass wrong that doesn't exist. So the guy who put it out is a really good person, but I think slightly naive. So as soon as he did that, I'm like, oh no, I don't need any more division. Because what happens is, and I already, trust me, I know this stuff. It doesn't exist, that rule. There is a rule that you're not allowed to copy presidential prayers of the priest. So during the opening prayer or Eucharistic prayers, you can't copy the priest. That doesn't mean you can't do anything the priest does. So holding your hands open in the Lord's Prayer is not forbidden. It's never mentioned yes or no. And the problem is that they misread it, thinking you're not allowed to do anything the priest does. Well, holy cow, that's crazy. That's crazy talk. Because like I make the sign of the cross, you make the sign of the cross. There's communal gestures that we do together, and then there's priestly gestures. We do a lot of communal gestures, sign of the cross, putting a sign of the cross on our mind, hearts, and lips before the gospel. We all say that prayer and act that prayer out together. We all bow at the same time during the incarnation. We do a lot of gestures the same. So to over-exaggerate and say, oh, see, everybody's doing Mass wrong. You're not allowed to hold your hands that way. And worse, if you go to the catacombs or frescoes in the ancient church, you have the Virgin Mary and other saints with their hands in that position. They're praying the Lord's Prayer. So during the Lord's Prayer, it's not a priestly prayer. The Lord's Prayer is a communal prayer. So you could hold your hands that way.
That just seems like such a small thing. That's just amazing.
The problem is, the origin of it is that they're making up liturgical rules that don't exist in order to get people upset with others for not following their made-up rules. And it really just explains their own psychological needs more than actually following what the rubric says. And the problem is, the one thing it produces is not more reverence at mass. The one thing it promotes is more division, that those people aren't doing it right because they're not following something that some Yahoo made up on the internet. All it does is create division and judgmentalism. And all these things seem to be, in my humble yet right opinion, increasing. Because like I heard this too, that when you dip your hands in the holy water, you have to use these fingers and not these fingers. Like, no, there's no rubrics that says that. Or this just happened like last month, where this guy is traveling, and this was in the newspaper. This was all over the internet. This guy was traveling to Sun Valley. He says he's on vacation. He drives to Sun Valley for mass, and the priest denied him communion because he knelt. So his whole family didn't get communion. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense, because I know the priest in Sun Valley. We went to seminary together. And like, while I tend to, as you say, be prickly, which I'm still hurt about, I openly admit I am very confrontational. I'd rather head a problem off and just speak it. But the priest in Sun Valley has always been, in my opinion, very deferential. He wouldn't want to ever offend anybody. That's not really where I come from, but like he doesn't ever want to offend anybody. So when I'm reading this, I'm like, that is not true. I don't know, but my gut tells me that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So of course, people here were upset that in Sun Valley, that this priest supposedly denied communion to this person's family.
So the people in your parish are upset by this guy who said he was denied communion in Sun Valley.
And he said he called the bishop and the bishop refused to talk to him. So I'm like, I find that suspicious. So I actually called and found out that no, the guy was never denied communion. Never denied communion. And he did, the bishop did answer his either email or call, I forget. But the bishop answered, and then the guy just kept peppering with more. So at that point, the bishop gave his answer. He's not answering multiple questions.
This sounds so much like it's a great example of everything that's going on in the country, too. I mean, you see this stuff on social media all the time.
He showed up there wanting to write an article about being denied communion. So he has never denied communion, but that article and outrage was already pre-programmed. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And the problem is that the priest did tell him, well, liturgically, the way to receive communion according to the rubrics is standing. So the priest did tell him that, but he never denied him communion. And like, the guy just wanted to create more division. And like, I have that here. So just like, there's this elderly woman who kneels to receive communion. But when she kneels to receive communion, I asked her about it because, number one, I was so impressed that an elderly woman can get down
can
on
kneel,
both knees,
yeah, and get back up.
Back up without grabbing onto anything.
Like, yeah, I would need something to grab onto.
Oh, I know, she's a stud. So I'm kind of amazed by that. So I asked her about it, and she tells a story that says, you know, I'm just so in love with Christ and the Eucharist. I feel like I have to. And she tells a story. And the point of that is that rubritically, technically, she's doing it wrong, but she's not doing it to create controversy. She has this real heartfelt devotion to the Eucharist. And I am amazed and honored at her devotion to Christ. So I would never give her a lecture on how she's doing it wrong. Technically, she's breaking the norm, but it's not out of this anger for division. It's out of this heartfelt devotion. And so you have all this, like, to me, there's a difference. It doesn't matter about breaking the rule. It's what's in your heart before. And I really feel what's in these people's heart is just some people, not the elderly woman, some people, they make up rules and then condemn other people. It's like, and I've told you the story. There's this one priest who's very, very harsh on made up rules. Like, he'll chew people out told the story, chews this guy out who's literally dying. He died. He's on oxygen in a wheelchair and he's wearing shorts. And the priest chews him out for wearing shorts to mass. He's dying on oxygen. Pants are tough.
Yeah.
And it's the middle of summer. Why would he, the priest do that other than, and there's no rule, right? So he's a little harsh. He always insists on being called by his last name and he's harsh on made up rules. And like he would be harsh on people if they ever called him by his first name, that you have to call him by his last name, Father so-and-so. So anyhow, I just think that's kind of funny because somebody was traveling and went to a bar and saw him in the bar. And just knowing that he's very particular, the guy walks up with his wife and says, oh, hello, Father so-and-so. He says, no, no. He says, "When if you see me here, call me Frank."
No, no.
So to his own parishioners, he'll be very harsh.
Oh,
but,
brother.
You know, I know. But here's the thing. What bugs me about that is he makes up rules for other people and condemns them for it, but then he gives himself an out for his own made-up rules. And those who have this deep desire for division, they make up rules and condemn other people for not following their made-up rules. And why these stories? Well, there's a group in the Bible that do just this, and those are Pharisees. Pharisees want to be better than everybody else. And so Pharisees made up hundreds and hundreds of rules and condemns Jesus and everybody for not following rules that they made up. And so the Pharisees love to proclaim that they're so much religious than everybody else. They're separate and holier, except when they meet God, they condemn God for not following their made up rules. And they'll take a rule from the Old Testament and over-exaggerate it. The same way like the hands at mass, they take a rule that don't mimic priest presidential prayers and they overextend it that you're not allowed to do anything the priest does. So they just kind of made up. And here's the odd thing. They're the enemies of Christ. They're the enemies of true religion. And what worries me is that there is this massive push towards Pharisaicalism, this kind of made up legalism. Not legalism that Christ taught, the legalism that just allows them to be superior. And so, like this podcast, I'm hoping that people have kind of this conversion away from it. And there's a story in the book that David Brooks wrote. The book's called How to See People. Love that book. That's my latest love affair is that book. But he quotes the Grant study. The Grant study was this study of all these Harvard men, and they track them through their teenage years to their death, to their children, just on psychologically. I think it's every 2 years they would interview them, and just what makes for happiness, studying a group of people over a lifetime and in their children. And there's one guy who they gave him the false name Adam Newman, and kind of interesting story. Now, this is really about legalism. He had the very loveless childhood. His mother had the ability to make anybody feel small, and she was pretty ruthless, and even tied him to the bed with his father's suspenders. And
wow.
I know, just very loveless childhood. He never spoke about his father, so something happened there. But his mother was very harsh and condemning, and he exceeded. Like he was an Eagle Scout, and he was compulsive just to achieve under his mother's harshness. Got excellent grades to prove himself to his mother, except the problem is the Grant researchers really disliked him. They described him as cold, aloof, rigid, critical of everybody. They found him repellent. But he does go to medical school, and he marries somebody in his second year of medical school, and both of them said that they don't really have other friends. The one thing he had going for him was he was very religious. He would go to mass 4 times a week. But researchers, when they interviewed him, his sense of religion was very legalistic and judgmental towards everybody else. But then he gets his job running this biomed section of NASA. And in his 40s, His daughter said that he was an extreme achievement perfectionist, but she also said he permanently destroyed her self-esteem. But this odd thing happens. When he reaches 50, about age 50, he has this middle-aged, deeper conversion to faith, where he comes to realize that the privileged in the world have a responsibility to the disadvantaged. And he quits his job and works with the poor as a teacher and helps farmers with crop rotations. I think it's in the Sudan. And then he returns. When he returns, he becomes a college professor teaching psychology and sociology and really leaning into mentoring the next generation. Then late in life, he becomes a city planner, which was his real thrill. But by the end of his life, the grant researchers described him as gentle and kind. And he said, this is interesting, in college, he always said that he was close to his mother. But after this conversion, he reported that he always battled his mother's dominance and criticalism. And he said, now when he thinks of his mother, he wants to vomit. And when he's 72 years old, researchers spoke with him for 2 hours and said he was incredibly cheerful and positive. And then when they left, he said, let me give you a Texas goodbye. And of course, he gives them this big hug. And the researchers said that they were entranced. And later they gave him a transcript from his previous interviews when he was in college. And he wrote back sincerely saying, you sent me the wrong interview. That is not me. I would have never said those things. He couldn't recognize his former self. And the point being, what changed from being this harsh, condemning, legalistic person who could only condemn other people to really being a disciple of love that just wants to unite everybody? And what it was his constant religious practice over a lifetime that changed him from being this judgmental Pharisee into this incredibly compassionate, true Christian.
Do you know, Father Len, you said something in this story about him, you know, being judgmental and really wanting to feel superior. This is the Pharisees, too, wanting to feel superior to everyone. And I wonder if that really is at the root of this, you know, finding things to disagree with, making stuff up to make you feel superior, to maybe overcome some kind of insecurity in your life about yourself. And so it becomes, the conversation becomes about you and making yourself superior. And is that what you're kind of leading to? That's kind of the cause of all this?
I think some people accidentally end up working for division in a community out of their own sense of anger, or maybe like Adam due to his previous insecurity or pain. Something like that. But that certainly fits the story of St. Paul. St. Paul is exactly the same. He claimed to be, before his conversion, he claimed to be super religious. But there's this murderous anger that just attacked the body of Christ with division. But after his real conversion to religion, St. Paul works to confront division with unity. He tries to destroy hatred with love. So maybe those who choose division do so out of some sort of painful insecurity. But I think in your life, you must at some point make this fundamental choice for unity or division, for hatred or love. Either people are moving to more extremism, which is more division and anger, or people make a choice like St. Paul or Adam Newman, that their life is going to move towards unity and love. It's a fundamental choice. And I have to say, just I love the stories of people. And I had this one woman, elderly woman, who I got called to visit. And she's incredibly sick, going to die. And so I'm thinking wrongly that she wants to be anointed. And she says, no, I don't want to be anointed. She says, before I die, and I really don't know this woman. She says, before I die, I want somebody to know my secret. Well, what's your secret? Well, when she was a tiny little girl, a toddler, there was incest in the house. She was raped. She got It's so horrific. I don't want to even repeat it because people would have their guts wrenched. It was an awful childhood. But this is the amazing part. So think about this. She didn't tell her children or her husband. Her husband had died. And before she dies, she wants to tell her secret for whatever reason. And so I was asking her about her life, right? And the amazing part is she was so sensitive to the wounded and broken of the world, like drug addicts and alcoholics. She went out of her way where she wanted them to know that they are incredibly loved. And I said, you know, really, rape, it's a way of trying to scar somebody's soul for life.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing that you spent your life doing the opposite. You want everybody to be free from shame and united and cared for. You went out of your way to take care of other people. So my point being, it's not what happens to you that matters. What matters is how you react. She chose to react by leaning into love and reject shame. She couldn't stand when other people were shamed. All it does is create division. But think about this. This has been in the church at different times of our history. Even like St. Paul was fighting division. So in Acts 2, it's been like 20 years since the first Pentecost, when people of so many different cultures and languages came together in one church, the body of Christ. And yet 20 years later, some people come along and St. Paul mockingly calls them something in the Greek, calls them like the super duper religious. He mocks them. And they start to create these deep divisions in the church by promoting made up liturgical rules. They have to follow their made up liturgical rules to be orthodox, not the apostles. So the apostles send Paul and Barnabas back to Antioch with this letter. And with the letter, he said, no, I'm the orthodox one, not you, not you and your made up rules. I come from the apostles. And unity is what the letter calls for, and the removal of any of these unnecessary burdens. Now, remember, St. Paul had his own troubled past. He was a former Jewish Pharisee that once hunted down Christians himself until he had this change on the road to Damascus. Blinded, disoriented, hearing Christ's voice, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Paul was changed forever. But 2,000 years ago, some Christians forgot that Christ commanded love and unity. And what they're really promoting is a Christian Pharisaicalism. So my point of all this is kind of like St. Paul's letter to the Romans. He warns about, and I like this, he warns about keeping your eye on those who cause division and put obstacles in your way. And he says, keep away from them. These people don't serve the Lord. With smooth talk and flattery, they'll deceive the naive. And then he goes on to say they have this hunger that causes them to use deceptive words. They use smooth and deceptive, flattering words like Satan to create division. Satan loves division. Satan loves to dress up as something good, but the only fruit he offers is not good, just more division. And the problem is the church has swung to this Pharisaicalism that just leads to division. And I mentioned before this other book that was tedious. I don't recommend people read it because it's so tedious. My gosh, it was hard to trudge through it. But it was a brilliant study. Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, where that's his one insight, is social capital. And basically the book is, oh, yeah. Did my sound go out?
Yep.
Is it back?
Yep.
Is it back now?
No.
Is it back now?
Yep.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. I got animated and started to swing my leg and then pulled it out.
You did that last time too.
I get excited about this stuff.
Yes,
sorry,
you do.
I'm not made of stone like you. So. But let me just, Putnam, his book, he calls it Bowling Alone because like things like bowling leagues and stuff in our grandparents' generation were very popular. people volunteering in churches and hospitals, people going over bridge clubs. Now there's this complete dive in all these associations, bridge clubs, and volunteerism is at an all-time low. So he calls that social capital. Social capital is a sense of unity and solidarity, a sense that I need to take care of others and build up the whole nation. And so he said, now our society has swung the other way from our grandparents, that narcissism is outpacing our social capital. But going back to the beginning of a country, he does this other study that I think is amazing. He tracks a social capital by studying the use of the word I versus we in American literature from the beginning of our country.
Wow.
And he said, just see how social capital grows or wanes. And in colonial times, the U.S. had large amounts of social capital. People mostly wrote with the word we. And with social capital, we can build and sacrifice for others. This country was built and succeeded because of social capital. But during the Civil War until 1890, which is the Gilded Age, there's this huge explosion over the word I rather than we. And what's going on psychologically is you have social Darwinism, the strongest survive. You have exploiting of slaves, exploiting of the poor. And so more and more, it's the I. But the reverse happens in 1910. There is this swing upturn back to we. And that's what got us through the Depression and two world wars. We much more thought in the terms of we in literature. It's used much more than I. So amazing things can happen. Then he notices that currently we've swung the other direction to me society. So it's not surprising that we have more division in the church that parallels this move back to the me thinking. So some Catholics who love to make up liturgical rules and condemn other people, I think it's because our whole society is moving to the me mindset. So they just make up, invent things to prove that I'm better than you.
But you know, that you're really describing, it's not just what's going on in the church, it's what's going on everywhere. And
yeah, I think Putnam does a good job on that.
It's interesting that these big events, if you look at them, like during the Civil War, we're into the I. You know, this is where we're dividing and divided.
And then all of injustice and hatred grows.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, you know, we have the Depression and World Wars, which apparently bring humans instinctively back together to unite.
I would say it can. Like there's a couple countries, like Moldova, they went to this bent of the me society, but as of yet, they still haven't recovered. Even like Peace Corps volunteers don't want to go to Moldova. It's because it's so divided and angry.
Yep.
But nothing can be done.
But over and over, your stories represent something. When I see some kind of behavior, my instinct is always to try to get to the why. Why is somebody doing this? And most of your stories, or many of them, when you're talking about division and stuff and the Pharisees, it's about, whether it's conscious or unconscious, looking, feeling, being superior to someone else, or having some insecurity being around someone else. So you invent things, you tell stories, anything to promote yourself and whatever. And it seems like we're in that place big time now.
I know, and I want to be clear, it's not what you do, it's what's in your heart. Because think of a little old lady that kneels for communion. She's not doing it to be superior. She's doing it out of this humble love of Christ.
Right.
So she's doing an action that is not liturgically correct. But how can you not respect her? The other guy that comes to Sun Valley, he's kneeling in protest, not of great love of Christ and other people. He wants a fight.
But you're talking about the why again. She has a very legitimate reason why she's doing it. You know, she's very devoted to Christ and feels like, you know, she should kneel down when she's receiving communion.
And her husband do, they're not from my parish, but they do a boatload of good work.
I'll bet.
They are just amazing. And here's the odd part. On Putnam's study on social capital, higher social capital tracks with more justice, more success in a society, but also a society with higher social capital test out to be happier.
Yep.
Societies with more narcissistic me, 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 less happy. Society with the more me, 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 there's more crime, more corruption in the government, more injustice. So, like, wow, social capital is paired with happiness. And what I want to say is if you read the Bible through that lens, what you realize is social capital, the sense of solidarity, tracks not just with happiness, but my theory is with holiness. So you have all these scripture stories of like Pharisees, right? Pharisees destroy social capital for their tiny little siloed group. Social capital is connected with holiness. And like one of the big words in scripture is oneness. So every Jew, according to the book of Leviticus, when you wake up in the morning, before you go to sleep, you pray, listen, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And Jesus said, and your neighbor is yourself. That your overwhelming prayer, and it's supposed to be the last prayer on your lips when you die, is this prayer for greater, greater love. But when it says that the Lord is one, actually the Hebrew idea doesn't mean one, like, okay, there's not Zeus and other. It means oneness, the source of unity. So St. Paul, he'll overuse the word one, like one Lord, one God, one baptism, one spirit, one cup that we share, one bread that we, you know, one all creates this unity of the body of Christ. And no offense to Protestant. Protestantism is, they believe in oneness, if you agree with me. Oneness in my little tiny sliver. Mm-hmm. And some Catholics are so boxed in and siloed that they become Protestant and they don't know it. They just care about their tiny little clique. And here's the odd part. This other book by Arthur Brooks, Who Cares? He's an economist. Tracking like who volunteers, who donates. Do you know religious people donate 7 times more than atheists?
Mm-hmm.
They volunteer 3 times more. And atheists and spiritual but not religious volunteer at the same rate. They do very little giving. My point being is that the Pharisees, Jesus mocks them because they don't give. They only care for themselves. They only divide the community. And going back this, Jesus unites. And the word devil, do you know what the word devil basically means?
Divide. I do, but my definition may not be where you're going.
Well, the root word is divider.
Okay.
The devil wants to divide us against each other. He doesn't want, you know, humanity to win. He's not for one side versus another. He's against all humanity. And so, like, this, there's a strange thing that some Catholics, we do it up here. After Mass, we pray the St. Michael's prayer. The St. Michael prayer is to defeat the devil, the divider. And there's this kind of interesting story that in 1947, this guy working in the Vatican at the time of Leo the 13th said that after Mass, after Leo had celebrated Mass, suddenly he starts staring at something and goes into this trance. And then goes to his private office, and his attendants were asking if everything is okay. And an hour later, he had written the prayer of St. Michael. And according to Leo's secretary, he had this vision of these demonic spirits who are going to attack the church. And Satan says, if you give him more time, he will destroy the church. And Christ says, how much time do you need? Well, he believed this time period of the Satan trying to divide the church is now. That's why we pray the St. Michael's prayer. So it just seems inconsistent to me. If you're going to pray the St. Michael's prayer that the divider fail, stop doing things that divide people. Pharisees loved to talk a lot about God and orthodoxy, but Jesus himself calls them sons of the divider. In chapter 8 of John, Jesus tells the Pharisees that their father is the devil, the divider. They are sons of Satan. And the end of Matthew, which we read for a Feast of Christ King, the litmus test of holiness is what you do for others. Did I follow the command of the king and reach out to others, or have I been just dividing people and then claiming to be religious? Because Jesus will say, Jesus mocks those who say, oh no, I'm very religious. Lord, Lord. He says, no, no. Not everybody who cries out, Lord, Lord, will be saved, but the one who acts. And Jesus unites. So united we stand, divided we fall. That's actually, I think, what Christ was preaching, what Christ gives us unity. St. Paul is preaching the Putnam study with social capital. So my point is the same point of St. Paul. Beware of Pharisees. Stop falling for these made-up rules that just divide us and make some feel superior. Let us be one with Christ and bring unity to the church. The same way our country was able to build this amazing country on the bedrock of social capital. That's how we got through the World War II and the Depression. Let's move away from the current plague in our country and our church that we need to attack each other. And like, especially in Northern Idaho, there's a lot of anti-Catholics up here. I'm kind of shocked. Anti-Catholics. Do we have to attack our own people over silliness? Why don't we become united and then we can build the church? Stop falling for these internet charlatans who keep saying, oh, if you don't do it this way, you're clearly not doing it right. And don't be deceived, as St. Paul says.
You know, it seems like you're saying something very simple to me, and that is division. The seeds of division are love of self more than love of neighbor or love of others. You know, you're so involved in loving yourself and promoting yourself and whatever. And I wonder if it's really conscious with people. Like you talk about the guy that went to communion in Sun Valley. Did he really want to create division, or did he just want to get noticed and feel superior and feel like, you know, he had the handle on everything and he was going to tell everybody else how smart, superior, how knowledgeable, he's all about the correct liturgy and whatever? I
think it's more like Adam Newman in the Grant Study.
Okay.
That you can't, like, think about Adam Newman. If you would have said that to him when he was going to Mass four times a week, saying you're, you know, being judgmental and divisive, like, unquestionably, even interviewing with his daughters, he was harshly divisive and putting down people. But I don't think he was aware of it because you're so part of your own world.
Yep, that's what I'm saying, basically. I don't think they are aware of it.
No, but for some reason, like, God allows us to have a conversion. Like, he has this conversion, but think about this. He had this conversion and he didn't even know it. He had this conversion. And then when he reads interviews of things that he said when he was 20 years, he just couldn't believe that was him. So, like, in some sense, we're incredibly blind. We're so blind, we don't even know when we've had a conversion. All we really know is what's our motivation sometimes. I just don't even know. But, like, towards the end of his life, his motivation is he just wanted to care and love other people.
You know, I've got this friend that...
It's not me, is it?
Are we still friends? I don't know. You were so upset at me at the start there because I used your self-description of prickliness on you. And you thought that came from me.
Mm. Yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, listening to you today and really thinking about this, I have this friend that always felt insecure around me, like, you know, And I don't know whether he thought I was superior or whatever. But he would always try to engage me in conversations about stuff that I knew very little about. You know, he'd ask me a question, knowing I don't know the answer, and then going, you know, you're such a smart guy. You should know all this stuff. What's wrong with you? And instead of bringing us together, it always made me not want to spend any time with him. But I never did sit down and say, you know, I really like you. You're a really good guy. But have you noticed that every time we get together, you try to find ways, you know, to engage me in this kind of a conversation that's actually driving us apart, you know? Because he was a good guy. He's the kind of guy that would give you the shirt off of his back. But my sense is that he just had this real need, for whatever reason in his life, to be superior and look better in front of people. And
you know, that's so funny. Now, this weekend, this weird thing happened where this older woman sees this guy who's probably my age, and she's thrilled, and he's had a successful life. And I thought it was a bizarre interchange because she was honestly thrilled to see him, mm-hmm. right? And showed up with his son and future daughter-in-law, and she's thrilled to see him. And she said, and he's had some success. And she says, well, I remember when you were a snot-nosed brat.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see the expression on his face, like, why would you say that in front of my son? And she, like, I think in her heart of hearts, she was thrilled to see him.
Mm-hmm.
But just had to take him down a peg.
Okay.
I don't think she realized she did it. And like, I was thinking, you know, if she would have done that to me, I would have stopped and said, why are you doing? Like, I would have probably just thrown it out there saying, I know you're thrilled to see me, but why would you say something like that in front of my son?
Yep. Well, I think that's what this guy, I kind of wish I would have said something. I never did, you know, because I think his intention, he really wanted to be my friend and wanted to feel like my equal in his eyes. I didn't feel like he was inferior to me, but I never said anything to him and said, you know, you're doing the opposite by, you know.
And I don't know what the right thing to do is. I just know we got to look in our own hearts.
Yep.
Stop. That St. Paul was saying, stop being deceived by people that just want to divide us against each other. I wish every Catholic, I'm serious, every Catholic in my parish in the state would just, actually, because it's so painful, hear this podcast. Like, let's stop that. We can build a great country and church with social solidarity. We cannot build anything putting each other down constantly.
No kidding. Well, Father Len, I think that's a good place to wrap this up. I hope people do listen to this. I mean, I got a lot out of it. I think it was, you know, one of our better podcasts. So thank you.
Great. Thank you.
And thanks for listening to this episode of the Wrestling with God show. We hope it does help you think about your own behavior, your own actions, and whether they are uniting or dividing, and why you might be doing it. What is going on there? And think about uniting rather than dividing in all of our relationships. And we welcome your comments and questions. It's easy to get those to us. You can just shoot me an email. My address is irish@wwgproductions.org. That's irish@wwgproductions.org. Or you can leave me a voicemail or a text at 208-391-3738. And if you're enjoying the Wrestling with God show, please subscribe, rate, and review our podcast and share it with your friends. It really does help people discover us and understand what we do and why it matters. This podcast is created and distributed by Wrestling with God Productions. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jake Einick and Kevin Barnett. Wrestling with God Productions exists in part because of generous donors who support our mission. If you've benefited from one of our podcasts, please consider making a donation at givesendgo.com/WWG Productions. That link is in the show notes at the bottom of this episode in your podcast app. So we hope you'll join us next time as we continue our journey, climbing the mountain of life, searching for truth, meaning, and purpose in our lives and unity in all that we do. Thanks for listening. See you next time.